Hello, my name is Christopher Gorman. I am a member at Rosenberg and Estes. This is our latest in a series of podcasts. This one focusing upon, in particular, the distressed real estate market and current trends in distressed real estate. I am a member at Rosenberg and Estes, part of the firm's distressed real estate group, concentrating my practice on real estate litigation, commercial litigation, a particular emphasis in loan foreclosures and loan workout work. I am pleased to have with us today Dr. Revel Cole, who I am going to allow to introduce himself.
Pleasure to be here. My name is Revel Cole. I'm a professor of finance at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton, Florida. In earlier part of my life, I was a staff economist at the Federal Reserve Board and also a member of the Banking Supervision Regulation Team at the Federal Reserve Board and at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. So my past life involves work in bank regulation. And most recently, I've been focusing on the effects of interest rate risk on banks' financial health, especially their commercial real estate portfolios.
So, Dr. Cole, it's our pleasure to have you here as a guest today. What kind of precipitated getting this together was, I think, our mutual kind of following of one another on LinkedIn. Your posts caught my attention, and your posts that you've kind of described as the bread and butter of your work more so than anything is what caught my attention. Can you just describe kind of what your areas of emphasis are and where you concentrate your research?
Well, my interest on LinkedIn really started after Silicon Valley Bank failed back in March of 2023. And that kind of caught me off guard. You know, we had this time, I think it was the second largest bank failure in history, followed the same weekend by Signature, which was also one of the top three bank failures. And shortly later, First Republic Bank, about 6 weeks later. So we had the second, third, and fourth largest bank failures in U.S. history occur within a couple of months back in 2023. And I started looking to see what was happening. And what I saw was that the pernicious effect of the fastest run-up in interest rates in the history of the Federal Reserve that took place starting with the first rate hike in March of 2022 and continued to 2023, inflicted incredible damage on the banking system. And so I started looking at various areas, first at the unrealized losses on their securities portfolio, which are very straightforward, their losses on their residential mortgage portfolios, but more interestingly, on their commercial real estate portfolios. It's more interesting because the losses on securities and residential mortgages are pretty straightforward because it comes through from just the reduction in the value of a bond when interest rates go up. So a mortgage is like a bond, the securities are bonds, and when the interest rates go up, the prices of bonds go down. But commercial real estate is a different beast. The mortgages on commercial real estate are not 30-year fixed. They tend to be 5- and 10-year balloon mortgages. But what that means is that mortgages that are maturing today primarily were issued either back in 2020 or back in 2015 before the rise of interest rates began in 2022. So we had a situation where we had virtually zero interest rates for 15 years following the global financial crisis 2008. And massive amounts of debt were issued during that time. Well, so what's happening now, it's not the value of the mortgages so much that's going down, but it's the refinancing. That there's about $5 trillion in commercial mortgage debt outstanding. And during the next 2 years, as much as a trillion is the new billion, has to be refinanced. Well, think about this. These mortgages were made 5 or 10 years ago, most of them in the range of about 300 to 400 basis points. They now need to be refinanced in the range of 600 to 800 basis points. And when that happens, many of these properties are just simply cash flow negative, and this is going to cause an increasing number of defaults in commercial real estate.
Is that the, one of my My favorite images that I see that you post regularly is a giant wave, which appears to be crashing into the tip of lower Manhattan. Is that what you're talking about? Is that the wave of maturities that people have been talking about, both in the real estate press and in the general media?
It's become known as the maturity wall of worry. And it is this growing volume of commercial real estate refinancing or mortgages that have to be refinanced or at least they're coming due in the next year to 2 years. What this has caused, though, it has led the borrowers and the lenders to engage in a game of what has been called either extend and pretend or more directly delay and pray, which is to put off those day of reckoning by extending the maturity of many of these maturing mortgages for 6 months, a year, typically not more than that. And so what this has been doing is, you had this sort of uniform distribution of refinancings over the next 10 years. But as those extensions are done, they're pushing up more and more of those into the next year. So the New York Fed has a nice paper by two of their economists called Extend and Pretend, and they have a nice chart where they show how this wall of maturity is building from 2020 to 2021, 22, and 2023 as more and more of these mortgages are extended out. And, you know, they can do that for so long. The strategy has been that inflation was temporary. Remember, Secretary Yellen and Fed Chairman Powell used that term extensively in 2022 and 23, that, you know, inflation was transitory, it was going to go down, and then interest rates would go down. And once rates go down, then that relieves a lot of the refinancing pressure on these mortgages. But what we've seen is that inflation was not transitory and that rates look increasingly likely not to come down much anymore. The Fed did start cutting in 2024 September, and they cut it 100 basis points. But that was the federal funds rate. Interestingly, the 10-year Treasury, which is one of the benchmarks to which a lot of these mortgages are tied, hit its low for the last 2 years on September 17th, the day before the first rate cut. And since then, it went up 100 basis points to 4.8, while the Fed funds rate dropped 100 basis points. It's dropped now, I think it's like around 4.3 today, but the recent inflation reports for the last 3 months show inflation is heating up, not cooling off. So I think we're likely to see rates to climb back up towards the 5% level in the long end.
Well, the strategy of extend and pretend seems a bit odd if you're a bank, but it's obviously very prevalent and has been prevalent for the past couple of years. What's your understanding as to what's motivating some of the banks to implement an extend and pretend strategy?
Another thing I follow is the exposure of the regional banks to uninsured deposits. One of the key factors that brought down those three large banks in 2023 was that all of them rely heavily on uninsured deposits. These are primarily business deposits, business checking accounts, in excess of $250,000 deposit insurance limit. And those funds are likely to be withdrawn, what we call a bank run, in the event that there are safety and soundness issues at a bank. So this is what happened with Silicon Valley Bank when their unrealized securities losses became publicized, and with First Republic when their residential mortgage issues became publicized. So it really only takes a whiff of rumor about some financial problem at a bank to set off one of these bank runs. So these regional banks, especially regional banks, I'm talking about 10 billion to 200 billion. There's about 150 of them. They're very worried about any bad press regarding their assets, especially their commercial real estate portfolio, lest it set off one of these runs. And so that's one of the reasons they have this incentive to avoid classifying these mortgages as non-performing or foreclosing upon them, especially. I've heard that a lot of these banks, they say the last thing they want is a public record of a sale of one of the assets on which they made a mortgage at a loss.
And so I know just from following you that a lot of your research and your analysis compares default rates at regional banks to the default rates that are being published at some of your more heavily regulated national banks. Is that correct?
That's correct. And also in comparison with default rates in the securitized commercial mortgage-backed securities market, where they don't extended pretend doesn't really exist there. So what you see in both of those, let's start off with what you're talking about. The very largest banks, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Citibank, and JP Morgan Chase, these banks are subject to a different regulatory regime under the Dodd-Frank regulations. And they have an extra internal audit function that essentially prohibits them from doing this sort of extend and pretend behavior. And so if you look, I've done a couple posts on this, where the delinquency rates at those larger banks on their commercial real estate portfolio is in the range of 4 to 8%. You look at the smaller regional banks, by smaller, I mean 10 to 200 billion, not small at all. They're typically under 2% in many cases at some of the most exposed banks, such as Zion or Bank OZK and some of the others, Flagstar, they're under 2%. So it seems very odd that these very large banks that have the best risk management procedures in the world would have so much worse loan performance than the regional banks. And some say, well, it's because they have more office properties. And that, to some extent, that may be true. But then we can also look for more evidence at the performance of commercial mortgage-backed securities, which gets reported by TREP, a data service provider. And what they're reporting is even more troublesome. Their distressed real estate report shows that distressed commercial mortgage rates are in excess of 10%, not 6 or 8%. I think 11, 12, around that range most recently. And they've risen considerably in the last 6 months. So that doesn't square with what we're seeing in the regional bank space, the bank space in general, outside of those few very large banks.
And so is it that extend and pretend mantra, in your view, that's kind of keeping depressed those delinquency rates amongst the regional banks?
Absolutely. There's also been a change in the accounting regime where the banks began implementing what's known as CECL, current expected credit loss, to account for these distressed assets. I think it began back in 2016. It's been phased in by bank size. It's now fully phased in. And CECL is supposed to ensure that banks recognize expected losses over the life of a loan rather than probable losses when a loan deteriorates. So you would have thought that in the face of declining commercial real estate values, and this is also another important point, is that nationally, commercial real estate values have dropped about 15% from their peak during the last couple of years. So never before in the history of recorded these indices, like the NCREIF National Property Index, have we had falling real estate prices combined with rising interest rates. So it's a very unique time. But back to CECL, we expected these new accounting provisions to force banks to provision higher amounts for expected future credit losses. We haven't seen that. And what I'm told is that there are provisions in CECL to look at the historical experience of commercial mortgages in the recent past, when there haven't been much in the way of losses. I watched a presentation yesterday by TREP on their modeling of stress tests, and their expected loss rate under the Fed's adverse scenario was only about 4%, which is just mind-blowing. The typical bank failure sees losses on assets, not loans, of about 25%. So to think that in a very bad scenario that losses on commercial real estate, expected losses are only 4%, it just doesn't pass the laugh test. And yet, a lot of banks are using this TREP model in order to project their expected losses under CECL. So this new regime has essentially, instead of providing the transparency we're promised, it's provided more opacity in this market.
And so do you have a way of determining, based upon data that you look at, you know, what the true level, assuming that extend and pretend is causing delinquency rates to be depressed, do you have a sense as to what the true exposure is within the regional banks at this point to commercial real estate losses and distress?
We know what the exposures are, and we can only infer what the loss rates are, like I say, from the commercial mortgage bank security industry, that from that space, and from these very large banks. So the bank regulators, going back into the, I think it was the 80s and 90s, have viewed any bank that has commercial real estate exposure equal to more than three times their equity capital, 300% of their equity capital, as undue asset concentration that requires enhanced supervision. And essentially, when banks reach that level, the regulators tell them you need to stop making commercial real estate mortgages and you need to reduce your exposures. Well, just to give you, I've been following this since First Republic Bank failed back in 2023. And they're just looking at the large regional banks that also have this extra risk factor of uninsured deposits. There's roughly 160 of them. And about 60 of them, so about 40% or so, have exposures over 300%. And a number of those have exposures over 400%. And some have exposures over 500%. If we expand that from just the regional banks to the entire banking system, which is about 4,600 banks, there's almost 2,000 that have exposures over 300%. There's almost 1,000 with exposures over 400%. There are about 500 with exposures over 500%. And there's over 200 with exposures over 600%. So the exposures are there. We know that property values have declined significantly, like 15% overall. Office has borne the brunt of it because work from home. But work from home has also spread from office to retail, especially in the big cities where people aren't going to work. They don't go to work. They don't go out to lunch. They don't go shopping. So this spreads from office into retail and other sectors as well. And we're not seeing the losses that we know are out there showing up in the portfolios of these financial institutions yet. We are seeing some information about this. I looked at restructured commercial mortgages. Starting in June 2023, this was about $6 billion. In the last six quarters, it's tripled to $18 billion. Now, under CECL, banks don't have to report most of their troubled debt restructurings, these restructured loans. So this is just a small portion of what they're actually restructuring. But we can see that if we extrapolate from that tripling, that this is very, very expansive, very common practice in the banking system. And this is why I think we're not seeing the spike in delinquency rates in past due 30-89, past due 90 plus, non-accrual that we normally would see under these conditions.
So, those of us who grew up handling distressed real estate, foreclosures and the like in the wake of the great financial crisis certainly have a recollection of what that was like. There was a lot of paper exchanging hands, obviously very heavy volume of foreclosure activity. The numbers you're citing in terms of distress levels and not being in compliance with various regulations, How does that level of distress that you're seeing compare to the levels of distress that existed in the wake of the great financial crisis?
Well, currently what we're seeing is way below what we saw during 2008 to 2010. I mean, it's probably we're not even a third the level of distress. But as I like to say, we're still in the maybe the third inning of a nine inning ball game. This is still going on. Let me explain. So when these refinancings happen and the properties have to go from say 300 basis points to 800 basis points, a lot of the times the owners we see are just simply handing the keys to the building back to the bank. The bank then has to, get rid of that asset, typically through a foreclosure sale. And we've seen these properties transact at 50 cents on the dollar and less. Now, so what that does is for properties that are not refinancing, it establishes comparable sales. Those comparable sales can be used by appraisers and they can be used by bank examiners to force banks to recognize the reality of the commercial real estate market. We haven't seen that yet. Also, the auditors for these publicly traded banks, they have to be, all the banks have to be audited, but the public banks have to report this on their 10-Ks and 10-Qs. And you would think that the auditors would be telling the banks, if you're going to be in compliance with CECL, you have to be recording some loan loss provisions because unambiguously the probability of default on these mortgages has gone up. But we're not seeing that yet. So until we get more of these distressed sales, I don't know that we're going to see the bad numbers reflected in the non-performing. But that's going to be happening the longer that rates remain high. And like I say, if we look at the last 3 or 4 months of inflation reports, inflation has been inching back up, whether you look at the consumer price index, the producer price index, or the personal consumption expenditure. So that's going to make it much less likely that we get the two rate cuts that the Fed funds, the federal, the futures market is currently pricing in. And without those rate cuts, this extended pretend strategy becomes less and less viable.
So the mantra of many real estate owners and developers in 2024, 2023 was survive until 2025, meaning that by the time we got to 2025, which is obviously where we are now, all the bad stuff would be behind us. I take it you don't think all the bad stuff is behind us.
This is a famous sort of rewrite of a quote from Sam Zell back in the 92. It was to survive until 95. And Sam Zell did very well because most of those properties didn't survive until 95. And he scooped them up and created a bunch of real estate investment trusts and made billions. So who's going to be the Sam Zell today? I've actually heard just recently people here now saying it's not survive until 25 anymore because we're here in 25. We're almost in March. And it's now survive through 2025. So if you can make it through the end of the year, and again, the futures markets are still projecting two more rate cuts this year. I just don't see it given the current trends in inflation. I don't give it given the current trend in the fiscal spending by the government. I know that there's efforts to cut the deficit spending, but I think it's likely we're still going to see $2 trillion fiscal deficits in 2020, fiscal year 2025. And with that, there's pressure on price levels because of all that deficit spending, which pushes inflation up, which is going to keep the Fed from at least from not for, at least from cutting. They may not raise, but I doubt there'll be any cuts in 2025. And that means extended pretend is a dead strategy. It's just a matter of waiting until the banks bleed enough to where they decide it's time to start foreclosing.
And so when you put kind of all of these factors that we've been talking about to this point into your crystal ball, right? Your data, your decreased property values, your higher interest rates, How do you kind of see all of this playing out, right? I mean, there's certainly a range of ways it could play out, from best case scenario to worst case scenario. But given what you know and what you see, what are your predictions for the next 12 months in commercial real estate?
The best case scenario is that economic conditions enable the Fed, the FOMC, to cut rates significantly. Not 50 basis points, probably not even 100 basis points. You know, you need, 200 basis point cut in the Fed funds rate. So if we got that, we got the Fed funds rate down, back to, sub three, in the two handle, that might make extend and pretend a viable strategy for a lot of these properties, but not all. The other thing that we haven't talked about is, it's not just the higher rates that these borrowers face. Because property values have declined, when they go to refinance, typically these banks want to do, say they want to do a 50% loan to value. So you had a $100 million office building that you financed 5 or 10 years ago. That property's now lost 20% of its value. It's worth $80 million. So you go back to the bank and you say, I want to refinance. Well, you had a $50 million mortgage. They're going to say, no, I'll do 50% of 80 million, which means 40 million. So you'd have to come to the table with another 10 million in equity financing or some other type of financing. So that problem is going to remain even if rates fall. If rates don't fall, then you have both of these problems. You have to bring more capital to the table, either in the form of equity or some sort of mezzanine debt financing, and you have to pay a higher rate. And a lot of these properties, it's just not going to work, especially the office properties in the blue cities, the big cities, the retail properties in these areas as well. If you look by property type at the CMBS market, the only property type that really has avoided all of this is industrial. Even multifamily has seen rising distress levels. So. And I make the case that even industrial, if you have a fully leased industrial property, let's say it's in South Florida where everything is sunshine and roses, then when your 300 basis point mortgage comes due and you have to, you're now going to have to pay 700, your property is probably no longer viable, even if it's a fully 100% leased industrial property. And then that's going to go into default. It's going to be sold at foreclosure. Undoubtedly in a foreclosure sale it's almost always going to sell at some sort of a discount. And again, then it's going to create a market comp for other properties, which is, that sort of allows these shocks to perpetuate through the system.
Do you see within the regional banking industry an appetite to get beyond extend and pretend to more global global resolutions, loan workouts, putting some of this behind us? Or do you not see the regional banks as being well equipped to do that at this point?
This is a really interesting question, because the last time we had a commercial real estate crisis, significant decline in value with a lot of troubled properties, was 2008 to 2010. That was 15 years ago. Most of these banks don't have anybody that does commercial real estate workouts. Those guys found new jobs. They were forced out, let go back in 2012, 2015, during the good times. Those people, they're gone. They're going to have to bring them out of retirement or retrain them and teach new people to do this. And the smaller the bank, the worse this problem is. J.P. Morgan probably has some of the best of the best, and they can hire the best of the best from consulting firms. But you get down to 10 to 50 million billion dollar regionals, they don't have the staff to deal with this. And so again, that increases their incentive to do the extend and pretend, because they don't know what to do with these loans if they do foreclose on them and have to take them into their OREO portfolio.
And I know that you think that some of this distress is likely to lead to a lot of consolidation in the banking industry. Can you just detail that a little bit more as to how this distress translates into, you know, and I've seen your, you know, opinions on this. You think there are going to be a lot less banks in the years ahead, as mainly as a result of working through some of this distress?
Banking consolidation has been going on for a long time. When I first started working at the Fed back in the early 90s, there were almost 15,000 banks. We were down to about 8,000 by 2000. We're now down under 5,000. I think it's just under 4,600 banks as of the end of 2024. 200 banks have disappeared in the last 2 years. So this is already ongoing. But what I see is that these, you know, there's 2,000 banks with commercial real estate exposure over 300%. Those banks, and I've talked to the management teams of several of those banks that have these high exposures, and they're under a lot of pressure from the regulators, the FDIC, the OCC, the Federal Reserve, to lower their concentrations. So they can, you know, do this by a couple of ways. They can, you know, stop making these mortgages, sell mortgages to other banks, which there's not a lot of appetite right now. Or they can merge a bank that's under pressure from regulators can find a merger partner that doesn't have a lot of exposure to commercial real estate, and they can merge together. If they don't do this, then I do think we're going to see a number of banks where the real estate exposure is going to be so pernicious that the regulators are going to close those banks. So my sort of crystal ball is if we're at 4,600 banks as of Q4, I could see us being down to 4,100 either at the end of 2025 or certainly by 2026, and maybe even below that. Now, most of these will be the community banks, the 3,000 banks under $1 billion, which we're seeing a lot of consolidation there anyway. But I think among the 100 and I think about 156 or so regional and national banks over $10 billion, that we could see, you know, 30 or 40 of those disappear in the next year to 2 years. And we could see a number of significant large bank failures during 2025 and 2026 because of these commercial real estate exposures if interest rates do not fall.
And so those, how do those consolidations happen? I mean, are those banks then going to be selling off their paper before consolidating, or is that not a factor in banks merging?
I don't think it'd be sold before the merger, because the troubled banks would essentially be signaling to the market that they have a commercial real estate problem. And one of the things I've been hearing is these regional banks, they want to avoid any sort of public transaction that involves their commercial real estate exposures, because that then could send a signal to the stock market where their stock price could crash, as we saw with Flagstar late last year. I think it was down 90% at one point. It's bounced back somewhat, but it only takes, you know, one bad news story combined with these uninsured deposits to have a really bad effect on the bank stock price, and to potentially cause a run of uninsured depositors would cause the bank to close. But what I do see happening is if you have a merger where a healthier bank without much commercial real estate buys up one of these banks that have the high exposure, then they have cover to sell off a lot of the worst of those assets, because they can say, oh, this was somebody else's problem. We're getting rid of it. We're solving it by selling these off to the market.
Sure. And so one of the things that really generated a lot of the foreclosure activity arising from the great financial crisis was the paper moving, right? So the notes were moving from banks to banks. They were moving from bank to private equity. The funds were sweeping in and scooping up, you know, hundreds of loans. We really haven't seen that yet as part of this cycle. Certainly some of the paper is moving more so, I think, than even a year ago, but you don't see that mass unloading of paper at this point from bank to bank or bank to private equity. And I take it that the reason why you think that is because everybody's trying to put up this front that, you know, don't there are no problems here. We don't need to sell any of our paper.
I've been working with several private equity firms that have distress funds that are seeking to go out and help the banks out by taking this paper off of their books. And what we hear time and time again is that, oh no, my paper's just fine. That guy over there, he's got some issues, but my stuff is just fine. I have heard from at least one of the firms I'm working with say in the last 6 months that they have seen a sea change. But that firm is going to the borrowers, not to the bankers. So the borrowers are the ones who have to go and refinance this. They're the ones that are looking at the biggest, you know, primary loss of value. You know, if the bank's got a 50% loan to value, that even if it's turned into an 80% loan to value, it's still got a cushion before it's going to take any losses on its loan. But the owners of these properties, they know things are going bad, and they know if they can't refinance that they will lose 100% of their investment. So they're now willing to say, go out and do a mezzanine tranche to do the refinancing to cover that extra piece of capital that they've lost because of the decline in the value of their property. So they may be losing 50% of the value of their original investment, but at least they're not losing 100%. So I do think we're going to start seeing a lot more of that. And I think that's where we're likely to see more and more of it, less on the bank side and more on the borrower side. And this also, what I'm hearing, this has created a huge opportunity for PE that is providing this mezzanine debt, that there's a market for this, you know, even at 15 to 20% interest rates, it's cheaper than trying to raise private equity in the form of equity. So there is a lot of capital on the sideline that's waiting to address this problem. But the bankers are, they're standing pat for now. I think in 2025, that situation is going to change too. And I think we're going to see a flood of paper starting to transact during especially the second half of 2025.
You know, I've said this to you before, and I say it all the time. When you talk to others who, you know, are involved with distressed commercial real estate, sometimes those discussions can be a little bit depressing. And somebody listening to you and I speak may think this seems a little depressing, right? We thought 2025, we were going to be at the end of this and on the back end and moving out into greener pastures. But there's people who are going to listen to this conversation and say to themselves, these are the opportunities, you know, that I've been waiting for 10 years or more now. And so to those people who see opportunity in the current distress, what do you say to them? What do you prognosticate for them?
I'm one of those people. I was offered a job as one of the first 10 employees of the RTC back in the early 90s and turned it down because it was too risky. And wish I had run my career otherwise. But anyway, so I think that these are great opportunities for people who are positioned to help work out this troubled real estate. And 2025, it's just a year of patience. I think that we're going to see great opportunities come out of this impending crisis. I think Schumpeter, who said, called it creative destruction, that out of the failure of certain businesses come better, more efficient, and more innovative businesses. And that's what we need.
And I know you think mezzanine financing is one of those areas where you think there is tremendous opportunity presently, and perhaps even more so on the horizon.
Mezzanine, absolutely. Again, as these properties have to be refinanced, there's this piece of equity there's this chunk of debt that they can no longer get because of the decline in the value of the property. They can only get 50% loan to value. So now they have to bring more capital to the table. Equity is expensive. Mezzanine debt isn't cheap, but it's a lot cheaper than equity. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity for that. But I do still think that later this year, we're going to see a lot of these properties transact and at much lower prices. And there are going to be a lot of opportunities for actually purchasing entire properties as well, not just providing debt to these distressed borrowers. A lot of these distressed borrowers are going to turn these properties during the second half of 2022 back over to the lenders. The lenders are not equipped to work them out. They're going to try and get them off their books. That's another thing. When a bank takes an REO property, real estate owned, foreclosed real estate, they want to get it off their books as fast as possible, write that asset down and move on. And so they don't necessarily try to maximize value by, if we wait another couple of quarters, we might get a little bit more. They want to get it off the books because it has a bad effect, especially if they're publicly traded, on their stock price. So I think we're going to see a lot more distressed properties coming to market in 2025 than we've seen in the last couple of years.
What do you think the lifespan of this current cycle is? I mean, people have said, particularly say, for instance, in the office space, as more and more office leases come up and they're due and people are moving out and not necessarily taking as much space or maybe taking any space, that this is a very slow drip for the office distress, and it's we're not going to see the end of that for many years to come as long-term leases in office space comes due. What do you think ends up being the end part of this cycle, or do you see a realistic end part to this cycle at this point?
Office is a story all by itself because of the work from home phenomenon. I don't think a lot of workers are ever going to want to go back to driving into a big city, an hour commute each way, 2 hours in the car or on a bus or in a subway to work 5 days a week. Jamie Dimon is trying to get his people back at J.P. Morgan. He might be able to do that. Elon Musk is trying to get the president trying to get the federal workers to do that. Maybe they can do that. I don't think most companies are going to be able to make that work. And that means we're going to see these vacancy rates in office markets remain very elevated. And a lot of these, the lower quality office buildings are never going to find tenants again. People talk about, we can convert them to apartments. No, you can't. Most of these, they're not cost effective for conversions. There's a lot of structural reasons, such as sewage capacity, that you just can't convert them on a cost effective basis. And those that you do are going to end up being the most expensive multifamily buildings in the city, which is not what the city fathers and politicians want. So that's not the solution. So office is going to be a huge drag on commercial real estate for many years, not just this year, next year. I mean, it could be 5-10 years before this is all sorted out in all the big cities. And I think ultimately it's going to end up with a demolition of a lot of these office buildings. But demolition of high-rise office buildings is very expensive. So it's going to be a long drawn-out process. Retail in the cities, because of the work-from-home phenomenon, that they're having the same problem, but not to is the same extent. I do, as I said, I think we're like in the third inning of a 9-inning game. So before we're out of this, I'd say minimum 2 years, more likely 3 to 4.
What is, in your view, kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the room that nobody is talking about that has the ability to dictate the severity of the CRE distress, how long it takes to work it out? I know you think it's interest rates, and that makes a ton of sense. But everybody talks about interest rates all the time. What's the thing that nobody's talking about that really has the ability to impact kind of where this cycle goes?
Well, certainly interest rates are the most important. And if I was talking about an 800-pound gorilla, I'd say it's Chairman Powell and the FOMC. But the other factor out there. As I said, there is an incredible amount of private equity out there that's being allocated and brought to bear on this problem. And as the problem festers and finally the wound becomes open, then I think this private equity is going to come in and pick up a lot of these properties and return them to the private sector and return them to health. It'd be very much like what we saw in, 92 era with the REITs picking up a lot of the distressed properties and securitizing them and putting them back together, putting them out there. So I see those two as the biggest factors that I can see.
I would say that's hopeful then. You're hopeful that private equity and capital on the sidelines can, yes, there's going to be some pain in the interim, but your ultimate conclusion is that with the capital sitting on the sidelines and smart people willing to work through some of the difficult times and the difficult assets, there's good things coming from this distress.
The current owners of commercial real estate are going to suffer the pain. They're already suffering the pain. They probably, most of them know that they already have huge losses on their equity positions. So it's just a matter of getting the properties out of the hands of these people who, cannot finance them and cannot operate them at current price levels. The price levels have to adjust. And once the price levels adjust downward, then the market will clear. And it's one of my favorite movies being there from with Peter Sellers back in the day. All will be well in the garden in the springtime.
Dr. Cole, with that hopeful, happy message, I'd like to end there. I think that you and I both agree there's a lot of opportunity going forward. And, I don't usually use the baseball analogy, even though I love baseball. I usually use the marathon. I do think we're a couple miles into this marathon, but hopefully that gives us, me and you, more opportunities to collaborate and talk about some of the interesting things that are happening in the distressed real estate world in the months and years ahead.
There are 28 miles in a marathon. I hope we're past more than 2 miles.
26.2. Yes. But we shall see. Dr. Cole, on behalf of Rosenberg and Estes, on behalf of myself, I'd like to thank you for your time. I look forward to continuing to follow you on social media platforms as the situation evolves. So thank you.
Thank you. I think you find me, just Google Rebel A. Cole on LinkedIn and you'll find me.
Okay. Thank you. Be well.
Bye-bye.